Guns, Germs, and Steel by Jared Diamond continued. Cassette 9, Side 2. These language replacements in East Asia remind us of the spread of European languages, especially English and Spanish, into the New World, formerly home to 1,000 or more Native American languages. We know from our recent history that English did not come to replace U.S. Indian languages merely because English sounded musical to Indians' ears. Instead, the replacement entailed English-speaking immigrants killing most Indians by war, murder, and introduced diseases, and the surviving Indians being pressured into adopting English, the new majority language. The immediate causes of that language replacement were the advantages in technology and political organization, stemming ultimately from the advantage of an early rise of food production that invading Europeans held over Native Americans. Essentially, the same processes accounted for the replacement of Aboriginal Australian languages by English and of sub-equatorial Africa's original Pygmy and Khoisan languages by Bantu languages. Hence, East Asia's linguistic upheavals raise a corresponding question. What enabled Sino-Tibetan speakers to spread from North China to South China, and speakers of Austroasiatic and the other original South China language families to spread south into tropical Southeast Asia? Here, we must turn to archaeology for evidence of the technological, political, and agricultural advantages that some Asians evidently gained over other Asians. As everywhere else in the world, the archaeological record in East Asia for most of human history reveals only the debris of hunter-gatherers using unpolished stone tools and lacking pottery. The first East Asian evidence for something different comes from China, where crop remains, bones of domestic animals, pottery, and polished Neolithic stone tools appear by around 7500 BC. That date is within 1,000 years of the beginning of the Neolithic Age and food production in the Fertile Crescent. But because the previous millennium in China is poorly known archaeologically, one cannot decide at present whether the origins of Chinese food production were contemporaneous with those in the Fertile Crescent, slightly earlier or slightly later. At the least, we can say that China was one of the world's first centers of plant and animal domestication. China may actually have encompassed two or more independent centers of origins of food production. I already mentioned the ecological differences between China's cool, dry north and warm, wet south. At a given latitude, there are also ecological distinctions between the coastal lowlands and the interior uplands. Different wild plants are native to these disparate environments, and would thus have been variously available to incipient farmers in various parts of China. In fact, the earliest identified crops were two drought-resistant species of millet in North China, but rice in South China, suggesting the possibility of separate northern and southern centers of plant domestication. Chinese sites with the earliest evidence of crops also contained bones of domestic pigs, dogs, and chickens. These domestic animals and crops were gradually joined by China's many other domesticates. Among the animals, water buffalo were most important for pulling plows, while silkworms, ducks, and geese were others. Familiar later Chinese crops include soybeans, hemp, citrus fruit, tea, apricot, peaches, and pears. In addition, just as Eurasia's east-west axis permitted many of these Chinese animals and crops to spread westward in ancient times, West Asian domesticates also spread eastward to China and became important there. Especially significant Western contributions to ancient China's economy have been wheat and barley, cows and horses, and, to a lesser extent, sheep and goats. As elsewhere in the world, in China, food production gradually led to the other hallmarks of civilization discussed in chapters 11 through 14. A superb Chinese tradition of bronze metallurgy had its origins in the 3rd millennium BC, and eventually resulted in China's developing by far the earliest cast iron production in the world, around 500 BC. The following 1500 years saw the outpouring of Chinese technological inventions, mentioned in Chapter 13, that included paper, the compass, the wheelbarrow, and gunpowder. Fortified towns emerged in the 3rd millennium BC, with cemeteries whose great variation between unadorned and luxuriously furnished graves bespeaks emerging class differences. Stratified societies whose rulers could mobilize large labor forces of commoners are also attested by huge urban defensive walls, big palaces, and eventually the Grand Canal, the world's longest canal, over 1,000 miles long, linking North and South China. Writing is preserved from the second millennium BC, but probably arose earlier. Our archaeological knowledge of China's emerging cities and states then becomes supplemented by written accounts of China's first dynasties, going back to the Xia dynasty, which arose around 2000 BC. As for food production's more sinister byproduct of infectious diseases, we cannot specify where within the Old World most major diseases of Old World origin arose. However, European writings from Roman and medieval times clearly describe the arrival of bubonic plague and possibly smallpox from the East, so these germs could be of Chinese or East Asian origin. Influenza, derived from pigs, is even more likely to have arisen in China, since pigs were domesticated so early and became so important there. China's size and ecological diversity spawned many separate local cultures, distinguishable archaeologically by their differing styles of pottery and artifacts. In the 4th millennium BC, those local cultures expanded geographically and began to interact, compete with each other, and coalesce. Just as exchanges of domesticates between ecologically diverse regions enriched Chinese food production, exchanges between culturally diverse regions enriched Chinese culture and technology, and fierce competition between warring chiefdoms drove the formation of ever larger and more centralized states. While China's north-south gradient retarded crop diffusion, the gradient was less of a barrier there than in the Americas or Africa, because China's north-south distances were smaller, and because China's is transected neither by desert, as is Africa and northern Mexico, nor by a narrow isthmus, as is Central America. Instead, China's long east-west rivers, the Yellow River in the north, the Yangtze River in the south, facilitated diffusion of crops and technology between the coast and inland, while its broad east-west expanse and relatively gentle terrain, which eventually permitted those two river systems to be joined by canals, facilitated north-south exchanges. All these geographic factors contributed to the early cultural and political unification of China, whereas Western Europe, with a similar area but a more rugged terrain and no such unifying rivers, has resisted cultural and political unification to this day. Some developments spread from south to north in China, especially iron smelting and rice cultivation, but the predominant direction of spread was from north to south. That trend is clearest for writing. In contrast to Western Eurasia, which produced a plethora of early writing systems, such as Sumerian cuneiform, Egyptian hieroglyphics, Hittite, Minoan, and the Semitic alphabet, China developed just a single well-attested writing system. It was perfected in North China, spread and preempted or replaced any other nascent system, and evolved into the writing still used in China today. Other major features of North Chinese societies that spread southward were bronze technology, Sino-Tibetan languages, and state formation. All three of China's first three dynasties, the Xia and Shang and Zhou dynasties, arose in North China in the second millennium BC. Preserved writings of the first millennium BC show that ethnic Chinese already tended then, as many still do today, to feel culturally superior to non-Chinese barbarians, while North Chinese tended to regard even South Chinese as barbarians. For example, a late Zhou Dynasty writer of the first millennium BC described China's other peoples as follows, quote, "The people of those five regions, the Middle States, and the Rong, Yi, and other wild tribes around them, had all their several natures, which they could not be made to alter. The tribes on the east were called Yi. They had their hair unbound and tattooed their bodies. Some of them ate their food without its being cooked by fire." End quote. The Zhou author went on to describe wild tribes to the south, west, and north as indulging in equally barbaric practices, such as turning their feet inward, tattooing their foreheads, wearing skins, living in caves, not eating cereals, and of course, eating their food raw. States organized by or modeled on that Zhou dynasty of North China spread to South China during the first millennium BC, culminating in China's political unification under the Qin dynasty in 221 BC. Its cultural unification accelerated during that same period as literate civilized Chinese states absorbed or were copied by the illiterate barbarians. Some of that cultural unification was ferocious. For instance, the first Qin emperor condemned all previously written historical books as worthless and ordered them burned, much to the detriment of our understanding of early Chinese history and writing. Those and other draconian measures must have contributed to the spread of North China's Sino-Tibetan languages over most of China, and to reducing the Miao Yao and other language families to their present fragmented distribution. Within East China, China's head start in food production, technology, writing, and state formation had the consequence that Chinese innovations also contributed heavily to development in neighboring regions. For instance, until the 4th millennium BC, most of tropical Southeast Asia was still occupied by hunter-gatherers making pebble and flake stone tools, belonging to what is termed the Hoa Binh Hiàn tradition, named after the site of Hoa Binh in Vietnam. Thereafter, Chinese-derived crops, Neolithic technology, village living, and pottery similar to that of South China spread into tropical Southeast Asia, probably accompanied by South China's language families. The historical southward expansion of Burmese, Laotians, and Thais from South China completed the Sinification of tropical Southeast Asia. All those modern peoples are recent offshoots of their South Chinese cousins. So overwhelming was this Chinese steamroller that the former peoples of tropical Southeast Asia have left behind few traces in the region's modern populations. Just three relict groups of hunter-gatherers, the Samang Negritos of the Malay Peninsula, the Andaman Islanders, and the Vedoid Negritos of Sri Lanka, remain to suggest that tropical Southeast Asia's former inhabitants may have been dark-skinned and curly-haired, like modern New Guineans, and unlike the light-skinned, straight-haired South Chinese and the modern tropical Southeast Asians who are their offshoots. Those relict Negritos of Southeast Asia may be the last survivors of the source population from which New Guinea was colonized. The Samang Negritos persisted as hunter-gatherers trading with neighboring farmers, but adopted an Austroasiatic language from those farmers, much as, we shall see, Philippine Negrito and African Pygmy hunter-gatherers adopted languages from their farmer trading partners. Only on the remote Andaman Islands do languages unrelated to the South Chinese language families persist, the last linguistic survivors of what must have been hundreds of now extinct Aboriginal Southeast Asian languages. Even Korea and Japan were heavily influenced by China, although their geographic isolation from it ensured that they did not lose their languages or physical and genetic distinctness, as did tropical Southeast Asia. Korea and Japan adopted rice from China in the 2nd millennium BC, bronze metallurgy by the 1st millennium BC, and writing in the 1st millennium AD. China also transmitted West Asian wheat and barley to Korea and Japan. In thus describing China's seminal role in East Asian civilization, we should not exaggerate. It is not the case that all cultural advances in East Asia stemmed from China and that Koreans, Japanese, and tropical Southeast Asians were non-inventive barbarians who contributed nothing. The ancient Japanese developed some of the oldest pottery in the world and settled as hunter-gatherers in villages subsisting on Japan's rich seafood resources, long before the arrival of food production. Some crops were probably domesticated first or independently in Japan, Korea, and tropical Southeast Asia. But China's role was nonetheless disproportionate. For example, the prestige value of Chinese culture is still so great in Japan and Korea that Japan has no thought of discarding its Chinese-derived writing system despite its drawbacks for representing Japanese speech, while Korea is only now replacing its clumsy Chinese-derived writing with its wonderful indigenous Hangul alphabet. That persistence of Chinese writing in Japan and Korea is a vivid 20th century legacy of plant and animal domestication in China nearly 10,000 years ago. Thanks to the achievements of East Asia's first farmers, China became Chinese, and peoples from Thailand to, as we shall see in the next chapter, Easter Island became their cousins. Chapter 17, Speedboat to Polynesia. Pacific Island history is encapsulated for me in an incident that happened when three Indonesian friends and I walked into a store in Jayapura, the capital of Indonesian New Guinea. My friends' names were Ahmad, Wiwar, and Sawakari, and the store was run by a merchant named Pingwa. Ahmad, an Indonesian government officer, was acting as the boss because he and I were organizing an ecological survey for the government and had hired Wiwar and Sawakari as local assistants. But Ahmad had never before been in a New Guinea mountain forest and had no idea what supplies to buy. The results were comical. At the moment that my friends entered the store, Pingwa was reading a Chinese newspaper. When he saw Wiwar and Sawakari, he kept reading it, but then shoved it out of sight under the counter as soon as he noticed Ahmad. Ahmad picked up an axe head, causing Wiwar and Sawakari to laugh because he was holding it upside down. Wiwar and Sawakari showed him how to hold it correctly and to test it. Ahmad and Sawakari then looked at Wiwar's bare feet, with toes splayed wide from a lifetime of not wearing shoes. Sawakari picked out the widest available shoes and held them against Wiwar's feet, but the shoes were still too narrow, sending Ahmad and Sawakari and Pingwa into peals of laughter. Ahmad picked up a plastic comb with which to comb out his straight, coarse black hair. Glancing at Wiwar's tough, tightly coiled hair, he handed the comb to Wiwar. It immediately stuck in Wiwar's hair, then broke as soon as Wiwar pulled on the comb. Everyone laughed, including Wiwar. Wiwar responded by reminding Ahmad that he should buy lots of rice, because there would be no food to buy in New Guinea mountain villages except sweet potatoes, which would upset Ahmad's stomach. More hilarity. Despite all the laughter, I could sense the underlying tensions. Ahmad was Javan, Pingwa Chinese, Wiwar a New Guinea Highlander, and Sawakari a New Guinea lowlander from the north coast. Javans dominate the Indonesian government, which annexed western New Guinea in the 1960s and used bombs and machine guns to crush New Guinean opposition. Ahmad later decided to stay in town and to let me do the forest survey alone with Wiwar and Sawakari. He explained his decision to me by pointing to his straight, coarse hair, so unlike that of New Guineans, and saying that New Guineans would kill anyone with hair like his if they found him far from army backup. Pingwa had put away his newspaper because importation of Chinese writing is nominally illegal in Indonesian New Guinea. In much of Indonesia, the merchants are Chinese immigrants. Latent mutual fear between the economically dominant Chinese and politically dominant Javans erupted in 1966 in a bloody revolution when Javans slaughtered hundreds of thousands of Chinese. As New Guineans, Wiwar and Sawakari shared most New Guineans' resentment of Javan dictatorship, but they also scorned each other's groups. Highlanders dismiss lowlanders as effete sago eaters, while lowlanders dismiss Highlanders as primitive big heads, referring both to their massive coiled hair and to their reputation for arrogance. Within a few days of my setting up an isolated forest camp with Wiwar and Sawakari, they came close to fighting each other with axes. Tensions among the groups that Ahmad, Wiwar, Sawakari, and Pingwa represent dominate the politics of Indonesia, the world's fourth most populous nation. These modern tensions have roots going back thousands of years. When we think of major overseas population movements, we tend to focus on those since Columbus's discovery of the Americas and on the resulting replacements of non-Europeans by Europeans within historic times. But there were also big overseas movements long before Columbus, and prehistoric replacements of non-European peoples by other non-European peoples. Wiwar, Ahmad, and Sawakari represent three prehistorical waves of people that moved overseas from the Asian mainland into the Pacific. Wiwar's Highlanders are probably descended from an early wave that had colonized New Guinea from Asia by 40,000 years ago. Ahmad's ancestors arrived in Java, ultimately from the South China coast, around 4,000 years ago, completing the replacement there of people related to Wiwar's ancestors. Sawakari's ancestors reached New Guinea around 3,600 years ago as part of that same wave from the South China coast, while Pingwa's ancestors still occupy China. The population movement that brought Ahmad's and Sawakari's ancestors to Java and New Guinea, respectively, termed the Austronesian expansion, was among the biggest population movements of the last 6,000 years. One prong of it became the Polynesians, who populated the most remote islands of the Pacific and were the greatest seafarers among Neolithic peoples. Austronesian languages are spoken today as native languages over more than half of the globe's span, from Madagascar to Easter Island. In this book on human population movements since the end of the Ice Ages, the Austronesian expansion occupies a central place as one of the most important phenomena to be explained. Why did Austronesian people, stemming ultimately from mainland China, colonize Java and the rest of Indonesia, and replace the original inhabitants there, instead of Indonesians colonizing China and replacing the Chinese? Having occupied all of Indonesia, why were the Austronesians then unable to occupy more than a narrow coastal strip of the New Guinea lowlands? And why were they completely unable to displace Wiwar's people from the New Guinea highlands? How did the descendants of Chinese immigrants become transformed into Polynesians? Today, the population of Java, most other Indonesian islands except the easternmost ones, and the Philippines is rather homogeneous. In appearance and genes, those islands' inhabitants are similar to South Chinese, and even more similar to tropical Southeast Asians, especially those of the Malay Peninsula. Their languages are equally homogeneous. While 374 languages are spoken in the Philippines and Western and Central Indonesia, all of them are closely related and fall within the same sub-subfamily, Western Malayo-Polynesian, of the Austronesian language family. Austronesian languages reach the Asian mainland on the Malay Peninsula and in small pockets in Vietnam and Cambodia, near the westernmost Indonesian islands of Sumatra and Borneo. But they occur nowhere else on the mainland. Some Austronesian words borrowed into English include taboo and tattoo from a Polynesian language, boondocks from the Tagalog language of the Philippines, and amok, batik, and orangutan from Malay. That genetic and linguistic uniformity of Indonesia and the Philippines is initially as surprising as is the predominant linguistic uniformity of China. The famous Java Homo erectus fossils prove that humans have occupied at least Western Indonesia for a million years. That should have given ample time for humans to evolve genetic and linguistic diversity and tropical adaptations, such as dark skins like those of many other tropical peoples. But instead, Indonesians and Filipinos have light skins. It is also surprising that Indonesians and Filipinos are so similar to tropical Southeast Asians and South Chinese in other physical features besides light skins and in their genes. A glance at a map makes it obvious that Indonesia offered the only possible route by which humans could have reached New Guinea and Australia 40,000 years ago. So one might naively have expected modern Indonesians to be like modern New Guineans and Australians. In reality, there are only a few New Guinean-like populations in the Philippine-Western Indonesia area, notably the Negritos living in mountainous areas of the Philippines. As is also true of the three New Guinean-like relict populations that I mentioned in speaking of tropical Southeast Asia, the Philippine Negritos could be relics of populations ancestral to Wiwar's people before they reached New Guinea. Even those Negritos speak Austronesian languages similar to those of their Filipino neighbors, implying that they too, like Malaysia's Semang Negritos and Africa's Pygmies, have lost their original language. All these facts suggest strongly that either tropical Southeast Asians or South Chinese speaking Austronesian languages recently spread through the Philippines and Indonesia, replacing all the former inhabitants of those islands except the Philippine Negritos, and replacing all the original island languages. That event evidently took place too recently for the colonists to evolve dark skins, distinct language families, or genetic distinctiveness or diversity. Their languages are, of course, much more numerous than the eight dominant Chinese languages of mainland China, but are no more diverse. The proliferation of many similar languages in the Philippines and Indonesia merely reflects the fact that the islands never underwent a political and cultural unification, as did China. Details of language distributions provide valuable clues to the root of this hypothesized Austronesian expansion. The whole Austronesian language family consists of 959 languages, divided among four subfamilies. But one of those subfamilies, termed Malayo-Polynesian, comprises 945 of those 959 languages and covers almost the entire geographic range of the Austronesian family. Before the recent overseas expansion of Europeans speaking Indo-European languages, Austronesian was the most widespread language family in the world. That suggests that the Malayo-Polynesian subfamily differentiated recently out of the Austronesian family and spread far from the Austronesian homeland, giving rise to many local languages, all of which are still closely related because there has been too little time to develop large linguistic differences. For the location of that Austronesian homeland, we should therefore look not to Malayo-Polynesian, but to the other three Austronesian subfamilies, which differ considerably more from each other and from Malayo-Polynesian than the sub-subfamilies of Malayo-Polynesian differ among each other. It turns out that those three other subfamilies have coincident distributions, all of them tiny compared with the distribution of Malayo-Polynesian. They are confined to aborigines of the island of Taiwan, lying only 90 miles from the South China mainland. Taiwan's aborigines had the island largely to themselves until mainland Chinese began settling in large numbers within the last 1,000 years. Still more mainlanders arrived after 1945, especially after the Chinese communists defeated the Chinese nationalists in 1949, so that aborigines now constitute only 2% of Taiwan's population. The concentration of three out of the four Austronesian subfamilies on Taiwan suggests that, within the present Austronesian realm, Taiwan is the homeland where Austronesian languages have been spoken for the most millennia and have consequently had the longest time in which to diverge. All other Austronesian languages, from those on Madagascar to those on Easter Island, would then stem from a population expansion out of Taiwan. We can now turn to archaeological evidence. While the debris of ancient village sites does not include fossilized words along with bones and pottery, it does reveal movements of people and cultural artifacts that could be associated with languages. Like the rest of the world, most of the present Austronesian realm, Taiwan, the Philippines, Indonesia, and many Pacific islands, was originally occupied by hunter-gatherers, lacking pottery, polished stone tools, domestic animals, and crops. The sole exceptions to this generalization are the remote islands of Madagascar, Eastern Melanesia, Polynesia, and Micronesia, which were never reached by hunter-gatherers and remained empty of humans until the Austronesian expansion. The first archaeological signs of something different within the Austronesian realm come from Taiwan. Beginning around the 4th millennium BC, polished stone tools and a distinctive decorated pottery style, so-called Tapen King pottery, derived from earlier South China mainland pottery, appeared on Taiwan and on the opposite coast of the South China mainland. Remains of rice and millet at later Taiwanese sites provide evidence of agriculture. Tapen King sites of Taiwan and the South China coast are full of fish bones and mollusk shells, as well as of stone net sinkers and adzes suitable for hollowing out a wooden canoe. Evidently, those first Neolithic occupants of Taiwan had watercraft adequate for deep-sea fishing and for regular sea traffic across Taiwan Strait, separating that island from the China coast. Thus, Taiwan Strait may have served as the training ground where mainland Chinese developed the open-water maritime skills that would permit them to expand over the Pacific. One specific type of artifact linking Taiwan's Tapen King culture to later Pacific island cultures is a bark beater, a stone implement used for pounding the fibrous bark of certain tree species into rope, nets, and clothing. Once Pacific peoples spread beyond the range of wool-yielding domestic animals and fiber plant crops and hence of woven clothing, they became dependent on pounded bark cloth for their clothing. Inhabitants of Rennell Island, a traditional Polynesian island that did not become westernized until the 1930s, told me that westernization yielded the wonderful side benefit that the island became quiet. No more sounds of bark beaters everywhere, pounding out bark cloth from dawn until after dusk every day. Within a millennium or so after the Tapen King culture reached Taiwan, archaeological evidence shows that cultures obviously derived from it spread farther and farther from Taiwan to fill up the modern Austronesian realm. The evidence includes ground stone tools, pottery, bones of domestic pigs, and crop remains. For example, the decorated Tapen King pottery on Taiwan gave way to undecorated plain or red pottery, which has also been found at sites in the Philippines and on the Indonesian islands of Celebes and Timor. This cultural package of pottery, stone tools, and domesticates appeared around 3000 BC in the Philippines, around 2500 BC on the Indonesian islands of Celebes and North Borneo and Timor, around 2000 BC on Java and Sumatra, and around 1600 BC in the New Guinea region. There, as we shall see, the expansion assumed a speedboat pace as bearers of the cultural package raced eastward into the previously uninhabited Pacific Ocean beyond the Solomon Archipelago. The last phases of the expansion during the millennium after AD 1 resulted in the colonization of every Polynesian and Micronesian island capable of supporting humans. Astonishingly, it also swept westward across the Indian Ocean to the east coast of Africa, resulting in the colonization of the island of Madagascar. At least until the expansion reached coastal New Guinea, travel between islands was probably by double outrigger sailing canoes, which are still widespread throughout Indonesia today. That boat design represented a major advance over the simple dugout canoes prevalent among traditional peoples living on inland waterways throughout the world. A dugout canoe is just what its name implies, a solid tree trunk dug out, that is, hollowed out, and its ends shaped by an adze. Since the canoe is as round-bottomed as the trunk from which it was carved, the least imbalance in weight distribution tips the canoe toward the overweighted side. Whenever I've been paddled in dugouts up New Guinea rivers by New Guineans, I have spent much of the trip in terror. It seems that every slight movement of mine risked capsizing the canoe and spilling out me and my binoculars to commune with crocodiles. New Guineans manage to look secure while paddling dugouts on calm lakes and rivers, but not even New Guineans can use a dugout in seas with modest waves. Hence, some stabilizing device must have been essential not only for the Austronesian expansion through Indonesia, but even for the initial colonization of Taiwan. The solution was to lash two smaller logs, outriggers, parallel to the hull and several feet from it, one on each side, connected to the hull by poles lashed perpendicular to the hull and outriggers. Whenever the hull starts to tip toward one side, the buoyancy of the outrigger on that side prevents the outrigger from being pushed under the water, and hence makes it virtually impossible to capsize the vessel. The invention of the double outrigger sailing canoe may have been the technological breakthrough that triggered the Austronesian expansion from the Chinese mainland. Two striking coincidences between archaeological and linguistic evidence support the inference that the people bringing a Neolithic culture to Taiwan, the Philippines, and Indonesia thousands of years ago spoke Austronesian languages and were ancestral to the Austronesian speakers still inhabiting those islands today. First, both types of evidence point unequivocally to the colonization of Taiwan as the first stage of the expansion from the South China coast, and to the colonization of the Philippines and Indonesia from Taiwan as the next stage. If the expansion had proceeded from tropical Southeast Asia's Malay Peninsula to the nearest Indonesian island of Sumatra, then to other Indonesian islands, and finally to the Philippines and Taiwan, we would find the deepest divisions, reflecting the greatest time depth, of the Austronesian language family among the modern languages of the Malay Peninsula and Sumatra, and the languages of Taiwan and the Philippines would have differentiated only recently within a single subfamily. Instead, the deepest divisions are in Taiwan, and the languages of the Malay Peninsula and Sumatra fall together in the same sub-sub-subfamily, a recent branch of the Western Malayo-Polynesian sub-subfamily, which is in turn a fairly recent branch of the Malayo-Polynesian subfamily. Those details of linguistic relationships agree perfectly with the archaeological evidence that the colonization of the Malay Peninsula was recent and followed rather than preceded the colonization of Taiwan, the Philippines, and Indonesia. The other coincidence between archaeological and linguistic evidence concerns the cultural baggage that ancient Austronesians used. Archaeology provides us with direct evidence of culture in the form of pottery, pig and fish bones, and so on. One might initially wonder how a linguist, studying only modern languages whose unwritten ancestral forms remain unknown, could ever figure out whether Austronesians living on Taiwan 6,000 years ago had pigs. The solution is to reconstruct the vocabularies of vanished ancient languages, so-called proto-languages, by comparing vocabularies of modern languages derived from them. For instance, the words meaning sheep in many languages of the Indo-European language family distributed from Ireland to India are quite similar. Avis, avis, ovis, oveja, ovca, ovis, and oi in Lithuanian, Sanskrit, Latin, Spanish, Russian, Greek, and Irish, respectively. The English sheep is obviously from a different root, but English retains the original root in the word you. Comparison of the sound shifts that the various modern Indo-European languages have undergone during their histories suggests that the original form was always in the ancestral Indo-European language spoken around 6,000 years ago. That unwritten ancestral language is termed Proto-Indo-European. Evidently, Proto-Indo-Europeans 6,000 years ago had sheep in agreement with archaeological evidence. Nearly 2,000 other words of their vocabulary can similarly be reconstructed, including words for goat, horse, wheel, brother, and eye. But no Proto-Indo-European word can be reconstructed for gun, which uses different roots in different modern Indo-European languages, gun in English, fusil in French, ruzhyo in Russian, and so on. That shouldn't surprise us. People 6,000 years ago couldn't possibly have had a word for guns, which were invented only within the past 1,000 years. Since there was thus no inherited shared root meaning gun, each Indo-European language had to invent or borrow its own word when guns were finally invented. Proceeding in the same way, we can compare modern Taiwanese, Philippine, Indonesian, and Polynesian languages to reconstruct a Proto-Austronesian language spoken in the distant past. To no one's surprise, that reconstructed Proto-Austronesian language had words with meanings such as two, bird, ear, and head louse. Of course, Proto-Austronesians could count to two, knew of birds, and had ears and lice. More interestingly, the reconstructed language had words for pig, dog, and rice, which must therefore have been part of Proto-Austronesian culture. The reconstructed language is full of words indicating a maritime economy, such as outrigger canoe, sail, giant clam, octopus, fish trap, and sea turtle. This linguistic evidence regarding the culture of Proto-Austronesians, wherever and whenever they lived, agrees well with the archaeological evidence regarding the pottery-making, sea-oriented, food-producing people living on Taiwan around 6,000 years ago. The same procedure can be applied to reconstruct Proto-Malayo-Polynesian, the ancestral language spoken by Austronesians after emigrating from Taiwan. Proto-Malayo-Polynesian contains words for many tropical crops like taro, breadfruit, bananas, yams, and coconuts, for which no word can be reconstructed in Proto-Austronesian. Thus, the linguistic evidence suggests that many tropical crops were added to the Austronesian repertoire after the emigration from Taiwan. This conclusion agrees with archaeological evidence, as colonizing farmers spread southward from Taiwan, lying about 23 degrees north of the equator, toward the equatorial tropics. They came to depend increasingly on tropical root and tree crops, which they proceeded to carry with them out into the tropical Pacific. How could those Austronesian-speaking farmers from South China via Taiwan replace the original hunter-gatherer population of the Philippines and western Indonesia so completely that little genetic and no linguistic evidence of that original population survived? The reasons resemble the reasons why Europeans replaced or exterminated native Australians within the last two centuries, and why South Chinese replaced the original tropical Southeast Asians earlier. The farmers' much denser populations, superior tools and weapons, more developed watercraft and maritime skills, and epidemic diseases to which the farmers but not the hunter-gatherers had some resistance. On the Asian mainland, Austronesian-speaking farmers were able similarly to replace some of the former hunter-gatherers of the Malay Peninsula, because Austronesians colonized the peninsula from the south and east, from the Indonesian islands of Sumatra and Borneo, around the same time that Austroasiatic-speaking farmers were colonizing the peninsula from the north, from Thailand. Other Austronesians managed to establish themselves in parts of southern Vietnam and Cambodia to become the ancestors of the modern Chamic minority of those countries. However, Austronesian farmers could spread no farther into the Southeast Asian mainland because Austroasiatic and Tai-Kadai farmers had already replaced the former hunter-gatherers there, and because Austronesian farmers had no advantage over Austroasiatic and Tai-Kadai farmers. Although we infer that Austronesian speakers originated from coastal South China, Austronesian languages today are not spoken anywhere in mainland China, possibly because they were among the hundreds of former Chinese languages eliminated by the southward expansion of Sino-Tibetan speakers. But the language families closest to Austronesian are thought to be Tai-Kadai, Austroasiatic, and Miao-Yao. Thus, while Austronesian languages in China may not have survived the onslaught of Chinese dynasties, some of their sister and cousin languages did. We have now followed the initial stages of the Austronesian expansion for 2,500 miles from the South China coast through Taiwan and the Philippines to western and central Indonesia. In the course of that expansion, Austronesians came to occupy all habitable areas of those islands, from the seacoast to the interior, and from the lowlands to the mountains. By 1500 BC, their familiar archaeological hallmarks, including pig bones and plain red-slipped pottery, showed that they had reached the eastern Indonesian island of Halmahera, less than 200 miles from the western end of the big mountainous island of New Guinea. Did they proceed to overrun that island, just as they had already overrun the big mountainous islands of Celebes, Borneo, Java, and Sumatra? They did not, as a glance at the faces of most modern New Guineans makes obvious, and as detailed studies of New Guinean genes confirm. My friend Wewar and all other New Guinea Highlanders differ obviously from Indonesians, Filipinos, and South Chinese in their dark skins, tightly coiled hair, and face shapes. Most lowlanders from New Guinea's interior and south coast resemble the highlanders except that they tend to be taller. Geneticists have failed to find characteristic Austronesian gene markers in blood samples from New Guinea highlanders. But peoples of New Guinea's north and east coasts and of the Bismarck and Solomon archipelagos north and south of New Guinea present a more complex picture. In appearance, they are variably intermediate between highlanders like Wewar and Indonesians like Akmad, though on the average considerably closer to Wewar. For instance, my friend Sawakari from the north coast has wavy hair intermediate between Akmad's straight hair and Wewar's coiled hair, and skin somewhat paler than Wewar's, though considerably darker than Akmad's. Genetically, the Bismarck and Solomon Islanders and north coastal New Guineans are about 15% Austronesian and 85% like New Guinea Highlanders. Hence, Austronesians evidently reached the New Guinea region but failed completely to penetrate the island's interior and were genetically diluted by New Guinea's previous residents on the north coast and islands. Modern languages tell essentially the same story but add detail. In Chapter 15, I explained that most New Guinea languages, termed Papuan languages, are unrelated to any language families elsewhere in the world. Without exception, every language spoken in the New Guinea mountains, the whole of southwestern and south-central lowland New Guinea, including the coast, and the interior of northern New Guinea, is a Papuan language. But Austronesian languages are spoken in a narrow strip immediately on the north and southeast coasts. Most languages of the Bismarck and Solomon Islands are Austronesian. Papuan languages are spoken only in isolated pockets on a few islands. Austronesian languages spoken in the Bismarcks and Solomons and north coastal New Guinea are related, as a separate sub-sub-subfamily termed Oceanic, to the sub-sub-subfamily of languages spoken on Halmahera and the west end of New Guinea. That linguistic relationship confirms, as one would expect from a map, that Austronesian speakers of the New Guinea region arrived by way of Halmahera. Details of Austronesian and Papuan languages and their distributions in North New Guinea testify to long contact between the Austronesian invaders and the Papuan-speaking residents. Both the Austronesian and the Papuan languages of the region show massive influences of each other's vocabularies and grammars, making it difficult to decide whether certain languages are basically Austronesian languages influenced by Papuan ones or the reverse. This book is continued on Cassette 10, Side 1.